Good morning, everybody. As a John Lennon, I feel like this is a Beatles era thing. When Tim was talking about, just saying I was back and all of that, as though it was extraordinary. And I mean, it has been a little while, to be sure. What came to mind was, and again, I think this was John Lennon saying something about the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. I am alive and well and glad to be back. More on that as we go, but really grateful for the time that we were able to take together as a family on a recent vacation. It was good to have a break. It was good to, geographically be away in this instance. It's also really great to be back home, and feels good. Just sort of a FYI. I'm going to take quite a bit, like percentage-wise, quite a bit of time today to sort of gently re-enter the series that we were in on stages of belief and doubt and that kind of whole exploration. So, if you were anticipating a dump of content that picks up where we left off, where I left off leading those explorations, you might feel a bit shortchanged for the moment, but we'll get to all that. So, just a little patience. We'll find our way in there. But first things first, some personal notes. A huge thank you, personally, to all the folks that took on Talkie Bits the last few weeks. Tim Penner, Misty Blake Knox, Tasha Gregory. All of you just absolutely rocked my world with what you shared. I loved every one of those Talkie Bits. If you are joining us this morning, either in the live stream or you're listening to this later on the podcast, and you haven't had a chance to take in those three or any of those three talkie bits, the previous 3 weeks to this one, I would strongly encourage you to go back and do that. It is so worthwhile. I'm always amazed at the breadth and the depth of this community. We're just absolutely surrounded by intriguing explorations of belief and intriguing explorers of belief. The honesty, the vulnerability, the integrity of what was shared in those three talkie bits, very, very powerful stuff. And I would say in so many ways, a model for what I think a community like The Table could be in terms of the level at which we talk and share with one another about what our own journeys are like. Just this incredible trust for the community's reception of those stories in each of those talkie bits. So, Tim, Misty, Tasha, thank you. And I mean, maybe every community's like this, and I'm just not aware of it. But I know that what I encountered and what each of you had to share gave me stuff to chew on for a long time to come. So, thank you. And also a big thank you to Judy for hosting the weekly and lunch after gatherings, for rearranging your Sunday afternoons around those for the last few weeks. Big gift to the community and personally, I received it that way as well. And also to Shireen for hosting a Wednesday evening hang. Just really appreciate all of that. Now, Tim Penner, you touched on this already this morning. So it's not just me. It does feel like a lot has changed around here in a relatively short amount of time. And by around here, I sort of mean Manitoba, Winnipeg, our environs generally. I think part of that is probably the most recent alterations to the public health mandates and guidelines, including, and again, Tim touched on this, including the new status of what has become the most dominant or at least the most visible symbol of the pandemic, which is face masks. And I realize that masks are not necessarily something that we usually engage with as symbols. I think we primarily engage with them. We probably don't think about it this way, but we primarily engage with them as tools or as things. They're tools that make a significant contribution to our safety by reducing the transmission of, virus-carrying droplets. And of course, they do that. That's not an incorrect way to think about masks. But having spent part of July mostly in Alberta and BC, two provinces that have been free of a mask-wearing mandate, for a while. I can tell you that returning to Manitoba, while that mandate was still in place for public spaces, reminded me of the powerfully symbolic nature of masks as well as their practical functions. It was just like a bit of a, you know, whack in the side of the head about that for me. And we're going to come back to that later, but for now I just wanted to note it as a way of turning our thoughts toward, in particular, toward the nature of change and how unsettling and demanding it can be. Also something that Tim talked about in really practical ways already this morning. Even when it's change that we want or feel we need to see take place, it can be oh so desirable. It can be just the thing we've been aiming at for a year and a half, you know, since March, way back when, right? When all of a sudden it was like, oh, this isn't going to be over in 6 weeks. Put on your mask, stay home, wash your hands, shut down the blah, 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 like the whole thing, right? It didn't take very many moments of that to go, can't wait till this is over. And now we're starting to see a different experience collectively of this that includes reasonable hope for moving back to something like we had before, and it's very unsettling. Change, at the risk of saying something obvious, but I think important, change is hard. And change is hard on us as humans. I remember old song, man, way back when I was like in high school, line from an old song in which the artist sang, "The strain of change does not appeal to me." No, it does not. And I think that's true no matter what realm it happens in, no matter what realm the change is taking place in, including realms of what we believe. So the kind of things we explore at the table every week can call for quite a lot from us as people because they often take us into the change terrain. I don't feel apologetic about that, but I also think it's very important to name it once in a while and to say it's okay to feel the demands of all this reflection, all this exploration, and to do what we need to do to step in and out of the process, in and out of engagement with that. That can take lots of different shapes, of course, probably as many shapes as we are people in a community, but that stepping in and out can, one of the shapes it can take is, can be pretty simple as well. And this morning I want us to think about what we're about to do together as part of that process, as a way of stepping out of something and also preparing ourselves to step into something. So we're going to take a moment to breathe together. And a familiar practice in our community, if you're familiar with this group and the way that we tend to operate. Again, optional, not a must participate thing, just as you're comfortable and as you wish. But what I would like us to think about our breathing together this morning as is a simple but deliberate way of getting back in touch with ourselves, of an opportunity to feel a little bit more like integrated people, a little more body, mind, spirit, all in the same place. So that's what we're going to do as we breathe together this morning. We're just going to be conscious of sort of pulling all the pieces of ourselves, if you will, into the same space at the same time. You know, the much used phrase sort of being present in the moment, for example. This is an instance where we can deliberately do that. And I think a lot of things can be accomplished by that, including stepping out of a challenging change process and kind of regrouping, and also feeling like something gets settled for us that makes it easier for us to step back into those challenges and not be so, not experience them as so distressing, perhaps. I'm going to practice square breathing, 4 rounds, in through my nose for a count of 3, cradle my breath for a count of 3, exhale for a count of 6. I'll do 4 rounds of that. Do whatever you're comfortable with. And if that's not being still and breathing, or your littles are, you know, leaping on you and being still is not an option, then perhaps another time. But if we're able, let's breathe together, okay? Here we go. Peace, everyone. One of the things we did lots of hiking while we were away together, but one of those hikes was with some family members that live in Chilliwack, BC, and we hiked up to a beautiful waterfall near their home. It was a fairly busy hike that day, lots of folks on it, very accessible, easy hike and beautiful day, so it was busy. And when I'm but it was through this, old growth rainforest, and it was gorgeous. And I was sort of having this mixed bag experience of this is a space where I would usually sort of feel like it's time to be still, and there's all this traffic and hiking traffic on there, and it was kind of, a bit of this and a bit of that, kind of both delightful and also not the space I would usually feel like I was in that kind of environment. And on the hike back out, I looked off to the side of the return trail, and maybe, I don't know, like 50 feet, 100 feet into the bush, somebody had strung up a hammock between two trees, and they were just, and there was no trail to the hammock. They just bushwhacked their way out there, and they were just laying in the hammock. And it's and being still. And in some ways that feels to me a little bit like our breathing in the midst of all these other things. It's kind of like we just kind of have to bushwhack our own trail off to the side a little ways and make this still place to gather ourselves. And as individuals, but also collectively, I think we engage with a much larger mystery when we make a choice to do something like that together, even though physically we're apart. Back to the subject of change and its demands. My sense is that we are living in this part of the world at an especially dynamic moment around matters of equality and justice, especially regarding the colonization of this continent, around the abuse of people based on things like the color of their skin, the cultures they call home, their expressions of gender or sexuality that are true to them, related sort of matters. I personally feel surrounded by young adults in particular who feel like their world is on fire, culturally and literally. Again, on our trip, we drove through at one point on a highway that was went right past an active fire. We could see the forest fire beside the highway. That fire subsequently jumped that highway and did considerable damage on the other side. But that day, the highway was still open. The world was literally on fire. And Taya said, feels pretty apocalyptic, and it did. And I feel surrounded by young people whose world is on fire, and for whom that finding hope in the middle of that is a real struggle. And sometimes in the middle of those kind of conversations, there is a part of my privileged white person brain that speaks up and says something like, this feeling that there are forces at work that are too big to take on and that it doesn't matter what you do, that's a feeling that oppressed people have all the time. An important reminder. And in moments like that, my determination to try to positively contribute to things like reconciliation is renewed. That's what that stirs for me. And I'm reminded in moments like that that big change is often an accumulation of small efforts, motivated by love, and that we need to not stop doing what we can, even when it feels like our contributions are being swallowed by larger realities. So, with that in mind, I would invite us to take a moment together to be consciously grateful for our welcome as a community on Treaty One territory, a welcome that continues to be extended even as the impact of genocidal programs of church and state right here at home become clearer to the wider population every day. They're not news to the indigenous peoples, but it seems like they're making news for the rest of us. Most of us can't really imagine what that kind of hospitality, what that kind of welcome costs to offer. But I think it's important to try. It is, among other things, one of the ways that we can see grace enacted around us every day. You want to be conscious of grace? Spend some time thinking about the costly welcome that the first peoples of this land continue to offer to those who arrived later. If you are a white person, someone with settler ancestry, perhaps, then I would invite you in the same way that I invite us to breathe together. It's an open invitation, not an obligation or a thing to, it's not a box to check. It's not an in-out thing. But I would invite you to take a moment to ask yourself a question, something like, am I grateful for the grace extended to me by the first peoples of this continent in continuing to make me welcome here? And if you are someone who is joining us this morning who identifies as Indigenous or a person of color, then I would say that it is not my place to suggest what you do with this moment of our time together, because you know the story from the inside in ways that I cannot. And what I want to say to you is thank you for continuing to help the rest of us learn and grow in this. But let's just take a moment for that, all right? Just briefly. Am I grateful for the grace extended to me by the first peoples of this continent in continuing to make me welcome here? All right. Well, I feel more grounded than I did. I hope some of you feel some of that as well. As a species, we are contextual learners. How we perceive ourselves and the space that we're in when we're having experiences has a huge impact on what we take in and what we just plain don't see. And this is a thing that we don't like to believe about ourselves often. It's not the way we like to think of ourselves, generally speaking, but study after study has demonstrated that we only take in a fraction of what's going on around us, and we're very selective about it. And so that's what I mean by contextual learners. So my hope is that we can come at the next part of our time together with the open minds and hearts of beginners, of people who know that there is much we don't know, and that often the more we learn, the more deeply aware we are of this truth. I think the author is Adam Grant. I can't remember the book title. We were with some friends yesterday evening in their home, which was delightful. And this book was on the table, and I flipped it open. And it's a book about this, in no small part, this contextual learning and the limits of it. And I think the blurb inside the jacket described the author as someone who likes to argue like he's right and listen like he's wrong. Argue like he knows he's right and listen like he knows he's wrong. We'll explore that more. I think I'll probably end up reading that book and the ideas will, you know, percolate up. But what an interesting idea, hey? And I hope we can come at what we're going to do here this morning this way. That we are people who know that there is much that we don't know, and that the more deeply we engage with mystery, the more profoundly true that becomes in our lives. Jesus called that stance in the world that of a child. And he insisted that, as we have the story, he insisted that it was the gateway to perceiving the presence of the divine, that you can't even see God present in the world without a beginner's mind. So I think it's important to us to remember that it's not what we hold so much as how we hold it, that humility remains one of the most important keys to applying what we learn to our lives in ways that are loving. It's just, Jesus, other spiritual teachers repeatedly tried to illustrate this. This stance around learning and exploring is key to encountering the divine within us and between us and around us. All right, so to return to this idea of masks as symbols, one of the things that defines us as a species is the importance of symbols to our whole way of making meaning. And anytime we're talking about beliefs, we're talking about making meaning. Anytime we're talking about religion, we're talking about making meaning. Anytime we're talking about making metaphors for mysteries, putting language around things we kind of can't see and know that way, we're talking about symbols. Probably the biggest, most often ignored example of this is language, and we ignore it just because we're used to it. We're so used to things like alphabet and grammar and vocabulary and so on that we can easily forget that entire thing is a system of symbols. And it's usually when we have to learn some other system that we realize just how arbitrary all those things are. One of the things we were doing, one of the areas we were in on this trip was, because it was largely a trip to go rock climbing, was we were in the Sea to Sky corridor, that chunk of spectacular mountains. It's right on the coast of Howe Sound, running between Vancouver and Squamish and up to Whistler. And as you get deeper into that territory, the signs begin to be in both the language of the First Nations of that area and the Stawamish people and English. And for the benefit of those of us who are used to the alphabet we use, those are the symbols that have been used for the indigenous names. But sometimes those symbols come up short, and so all of a sudden there'll be a string of, you know, recognizable letters spelling a word that I don't recognize because that's not my language. But in the middle of that string of A, B, C, D, E, F, there'll be numbers. There'll suddenly be a seven, or what looks like a seven. And so the realization that there's a whole different set of symbols that could have been used for that entire name, but it would have been incomprehensible. And so there's to the majority of people going past the sign, and so there's an intermediate set of symbols, an attempt to find the space in between what we don't know and what we're familiar with to communicate something important about the coexistence of those things. So when we have to learn this other system, when we have to learn another set of shapes that represent sounds, that represent ideas, that become language, we realize it's kind of arbitrary. They're symbols that we made. And so one of the things that intrigues me, I just mentioned that language part of the alphabet part of the signs, but one of the things that intrigues me when I travel is seeing new to me, you know, universal symbols on signs. So these are the things that tell us what's coming up, right? Like, we're familiar with lots of them. We see them over and over again beside the road. We're familiar with the symbol for, you know, restroom, although I did see a new one. Instead of the gender binary and the little house, you know, that says outhouse for both men and women, there's a new symbol, and it's a toilet. It's a genderless toilet, like the actual fixture, which also says there's bathrooms here and campgrounds and rest areas. And so we're familiar with some of those kind of common ones, right? And they're meant to communicate to everybody that roars past them at 100 kilometers an hour. You can just glance at them and go, oh, I know what that means. So what I like is when I encounter ones that I've never seen before that aren't familiar to me, and it's interesting, and sometimes it's a bit head-scratching, right? Some of them are kind of obvious. So, like, for example, when you're driving through Calgary on the number 16, or the old number 1 used to go through the heart of Calgary, you drive past Olympic Park, and included on the signs about Olympic Park is one for ski jumping, like for the Olympic sport where, the long skis and the person sort of flies through the air for a long time off a huge ramp. There's a symbol for that, which is, you know, a person on these huge skis flying through the air. And you can look at that one and kind of go, oh, ski jump. Even if you've never seen the sign before, at least for me, it kind of clicks. But I saw a couple this trip further west that I'd never seen before and that I had to look up. One was for tsunami danger, which is like a figure climbing a cliff, and there's this wave coming to kind of eat them, and the wave kind of looks like a combination of surf and a shark. It's like, right? This is just really ferocious looking wave coming to eat the human. So run is the idea. Tsunami danger. And the other one I saw looked like, I don't know if this is a familiar idea to you or not, but looked like a World War I hand grenade, like a little bulb with a smaller bulb on top and a thing coming out of the top. And it's actually the symbol for a distillery, not for a hand grenade. I haven't quite figured that one out yet. I need to spend a little more time. That one still got me scratching my head. It's not always clear, long illustration, it's not always clear what a symbol means. And of course, lots of symbols, including things like face masks, can have more than one meaning, right? Face masks can mean I'm keeping the rules. If someone's nose is sticking out, it's just over their mouth, it might mean I'm keeping the rules, but I'm keeping them grudgingly. Or it might just as well mean I feel like I'm suffocating and I have panic attacks when I cover both my airway intakes, so this is me doing the best that I can. They might symbolize care. Tim talked about this. I'm double vaccinated, I'm not worried about me, but I want to protect you too, so I'm wearing a mask. They might symbolize solidarity. My kid needs to wear this. I want them to know I'm fully on board. I'm going to wear mine. I'm going to join with them in this uncomfortable and important measure. They might symbolize interference of government with my rights and freedoms. I might have that perspective, and so on. So same symbol, pandemic measure might mean a lot of different things, right? And that same dynamic is true for symbols that we might want to use to help us explore or signify meaning within our systems of belief. The last week before we went on vacation, I talked about Richard Rohr's illustration of boxes of order, disorder, and reorder, and use these physical boxes to illustrate that. We don't live our lives in literal boxes, of course. So even though I had literal boxes on the table in front of me when I talked about that, those were symbols. And when I shared that illustration, I went to some lengths to say that it's important to think of the boxes as having no lids and as existing within a much larger, even an infinitely expanding space that we might call mystery. I have yet to see a highway sign symbol for mystery, a universal symbol for mystery. But oh my goodness, are there ever a lot of symbols for mystery? Maybe that's why we can't get to a universal one. We'll talk about that in a bit. But when we make meaning, which is what we're doing when we make religions, we are making symbols for mystery. This idea that the boxes would be lidless, that's an important idea for lots of reasons, including not getting boxed in by our own symbol making. This doesn't make it less important. We just have to keep a grip on its limitations, if you will. If we start to use an idea like boxes in thinking about our own life experiences, the benefit of that might be, and there might be many, but here's one, the benefit of that might be some clarity that we didn't have before. Those symbols and that idea might help us kind of imagine a framework for experiences that clarifies them for us. The downside can easily be that we limit our thinking about our own life experiences and those of others, that we start to put humans into boxes as though that was a sufficient way to understand and explain us. And it isn't. And that's important. So, especially when it comes to things like what we believe about mysteries that are beyond us. In the end, any ideas that we use to explore what we believe will be partial. They will be incomplete. And whatever else might be true about what we might use God language for, that realm of exploration is categorically so enormous, it's expanding, that it requires more than one point of view. Let me illustrate this from a common sort of religious idea. Let's say that we are that we have our experience of meaning as regards God and religion and that realm of mystery in the box of right belief. If we are operating in the box of right belief, we now need to do, because we in that box we believe that what's in that box is the answer, we now need to do whatever is necessary to get everyone else into that box with us. It would not even be loving to do otherwise from that perspective, right? So if our beliefs in that box include a binary, sort of like an upstairs downstairs system of reward and punishment, then we can easily start to believe that the only loving thing to do is to get everyone into the box of our belief with us, no matter what it takes to do so. And the true believers in that box will do anything. They die for that mission, right? Because it's the right thing to do. It's the true thing to do. And so this is one of the lenses, which is kind of an interesting idea, right? This is one of the lenses through which we might view an endeavor like residential schools. If we, as a human, hold the idea that someone else's already existing beliefs might keep them from being inside our box of right belief with us, then we might also believe that the right thing to do is to strip them of those beliefs and their attendant cultural expressions, even if it kills them. Because that, from that perspective, might be perceived as the only way that they can be saved from the horror of being lost outside of our box of right belief, the one we live in. So there's this tension-filled space between this idea is helpful and this idea is the last word. That's a tough one to live in. It's a challenging one to live in, not least of all because It's a space of constant change, if you will. But it's one we need to be willing to try to engage if we want to continue through life as learning, growing people. It's what can help us continue to seek the goal of expressing our spirituality as love. So if we hold beliefs that can't be expressed as love, then I would say that it might be well worth examining either that belief itself or examining how we're holding it. We seem to, as a species, we seem to have a remarkable capacity for weaponizing just about anything. And if we're surrounded by people that are doing that same thing that we're doing, it's possible to not even know that's what we're doing. Sincerity is a really poor measure of whether we are doing what is good and right. To put it another way, we need other points of view. We need other people. We need other systems of belief in our lived experience, if only to save us from our tendency to start regarding our point of view as the only valid one, to stop listening like we know we're wrong. Which, in a roundabout way, because that's the way that I seem to travel, isn't it? In a roundabout way, brings us back to our exploration of this idea of stages of doubt and belief and the interaction of those things. That model, that stages schema, it's subject to all those same problems. And it also carries the potential to help us look at our own experiences and those of others from more than one vantage point. So, as we work with it, we need to keep that in view. I'm going to use the balance of our time to sort of just briefly recap those stages as we've considered them so far, and to sort of set the stage for where we'll be headed next. So to briefly recap those stages with those ideas that I've just been talking about clearly in view, let's just review a little bit here. So stage zero is where we started. The stage before the stages is one of the things that we called it. Stage zero can be best understood as aligned with infancy. In many cases, quite literally aligned as a stage of belief with a stage of development for us as humans, with biological, chronological infancy. So this is the stage at which we are utterly dependent and where our experience is that we are the center of the universe. This is the stage that is all about me, and my concept of a good world is one in which everything goes my way. When we encounter grown-ups who have not moved out of this stage, we wouldn't tend to affirm that view. The world is not all about you. The world is not all about me. But that in that stage, it is. So, in stage zero, it is never my fault when things don't go my way. It's always somebody else's fault. And the good people in my world are the people that do what I want, and the bad people are the people that don't do what I want. So trusting something beyond me, my God concept in that stage, is basically equal to trusting my caregivers, the ones who give me what I want. If you want a more detailed exploration of this stage, you can go back and find it on the June 6th podcast, which is called I Doubt It, Part 2, The Importance of Evolving Faith. So then beyond stage zero, we got into stage one. And stage one is where we get our dualism, our either-or engine fired up, and we start to learn whatever it is that our caregivers regard as the necessary moral framework for living in the world. There are, of course, moral frameworks not like the one I'm about to describe, but the majority of us would have been raised in a framework of right and wrong at this stage. We learn how, in stage one, how some behaviors are rewarded and other behaviors are punished, and we learn how to submit to authorities and to obey the rules. In this stage, we learn how to try to keep the big people happy, or at least to keep them off our case. And in many religious settings, this is a stage where we learn about God as the ultimate big person. This is sort of the anthropomorphization of the mystery of God, right, in this stage, where God is figures like father and son, you know, like very human figures, right? So we learn to think about God in this stage as the ultimate big person, and we learn to apply dualistic, either-or thinking, to that realm of belief as well. So we learn the religious rules, We learn how to keep them. We learn what the boundary markers are for our communities and that we shouldn't violate them, or if we do, we better keep it a secret. And that the ultimate big person, so this personification of the divine, if we keep the rules, the ultimate big person won't punish us, won't whack us. And in fact, if we're really good, this is the perspective of stage one, that ultimate big person might take us under their wing, and might protect us from some of the vicissitudes, the uncertainties of life. And if we're very good and we really keep the right rules, right way, they might even reward us with things like health or wealth or power. So this stage one, offers a powerful and potentially very reassuring view of the world. It's not really that hard to see its attraction, I think. Especially if we can surround ourselves with others who see the world the same way. And this is one of the keys to this whole thing working, is that it constantly needs to be reinforced. And one of the reasons that's the case is because there are so many legitimate challenges to it. But if we can keep facing inward with others who believe the same, and there's constant reinforcement of that system of belief, it can be a very comforting space to be in. And so some people never leave it. But for others, the cracks in the system become visible and it starts to feel impossible to stay there. And the phrase that we've been using to kind of capture some of that experience is the phrase, I doubt it. I doubt it becomes a very important experience to some people. Doubt, of course, has no place in dualism. To doubt is to be in a disallowed, useless, or at best temporary space, a space that is only catalytic, only understood to be positively catalytic if it turns you back into the box of right belief, right? So if you're doubting and you're in stage one, what you need to do is you need to get off the fence. You need to decide, are you in? Are you out? You need to commit. Maybe you need to recommit because you've been backsliding. Anybody finding those words triggering has my apologies. Perhaps you need to bow your knee to God. You need to bend that rebellious will you're exhibiting. Face back inward. The idea in stage one, the idea that doubt might be the very thing that provides the catalyst for positive evolution, that's an idea that rarely makes an appearance in stage one. And when it does, it is usually promptly sent packing, often with the sort of logic that says you just started down a slippery slope and the end of it is destruction. Don't go there. But if we will let it, if we will let it, doubt can save us. By which I mean, doubt can help us move to another stage of belief, another point of view, rather than falling victim to the dualism of you're either in or out by deciding that since we can't be in because of our doubts, we must be out. So, keeping stage zero, which we could sum up as infancy or egocentricity, and stage one, which we could sum up as simplicity, keeping those in view, next week we're going to take a much deeper dive into stage two. I won't say now what the summary name for that stage is. I just think it's more fun to kind of work our way up to it by exploring it together. So that's where we're going to leave that exploration for this week. And I can't even tell you how good it feels to be re-engaging with this in this context. I've been reminded through the course of many conversations over the last few weeks as we've been with people that we don't normally have a chance to spend time with as we traveled, I've been reminded over and over again of the, I'm not going to say unique because there may be others, I just don't know, but certainly of the not frequently found space that the table occupies in community expressions of exploring what we believe. There just aren't very many communities doing what we're doing, which to me feels like a sad thing, mostly, but also a glad thing in the sense that I and we get to participate in it together. And I think that's a great gift. We are doing together, what millions of people find themselves doing alone, which is exploring what they believe. and millions of people are having the experience of wondering if it's possible to believe if they don't believe the way that they were told they must. And they're just coming to the conclusion that they must not have anything that they could call faith if they can't have what they were told was the faith. And I think to participate in a community that says something different than that about that human experience, that's oh so common human experience of doubt and wondering what next looks like if it doesn't look like the thing we were told was the one true thing. We get to do this, folks. We get to do this. Great privilege. I'm so grateful. Thanks for being a part of this, in whatever way it is that you join together with it.